Today is Wednesday, November the 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Coming up, the House Judiciary Committee has invited President Donald Trump to owe his counsel to participate in the panel's first impeachment hearings, which start next week. A defiant Mr. Trump addressed what his campaign dubbed a homecoming rally near Miami on Tuesday.
The radical left Democrats are trying to rip our nation apart.
Also ahead, rescue efforts continue in Albania as citizens dig out from Tuesday's deadly earthquake. At least 26 people died in the quake, which hit the largest city, the second largest city. It's all on today's International Edition. The House Judiciary Committee has invited President Donald Trump or his counsel to participate in the panel's first impeachment hearing next week as the House moves another step closer to holding a vote on impeaching the president. It is not clear whether he will accept the invitation or not. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joins me in studio. So, Catherine, the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, I believe?
That's correct.
Said in his letter that he's not compelled by law to invite the president. Now, given his past pronouncements, President Trump's past pronouncements on these impeachment hearings, do you see the president sending his counsel or even appearing himself at these committee hearings?
You know, despite what President Trump has tweeted in the past about wanting to defend himself in a trial, I don't think we should expect to see the president or his counsel show up next week at this House Judiciary Committee hearing. It really would deprive the president and his Republican allies on Capitol Hill of one of their key arguments that they've been making throughout this impeachment inquiry process, and that's that Democrats, House Democrats, have really run this in a way that's deeply unfair to the president. If he shows up or if his counsel shows up, then they kind of be buying into that process and their argument would be taken away.
Mm. So what does this new phase of hearings differ from last week's hearings, where we had testimony from State Department officials and administrative officials like Ambassador Sondland?
Well, this initial hearing in the House Judiciary Committee next week is going to look really different from what we saw in House Intelligence Committee hearings. Mm. And that's because we saw all of those 12 witnesses come before the House Intelligence Committee. This House Judiciary hearing is going to be different because constitutional law scholars are going to be picking apart the issue of what exactly constitutes an impeachable offense and whether or not President Trump committed one. So we're actually going to be getting more into the legal nitty-gritty details of all of this in next week's hearing.
And so tomorrow is Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving, by the way.
Sure.
Does this holiday season affect the momentum as we talk about, as the Americans talk about these impeachment hearings? Does it affect the momentum?
I think it absolutely does because, in particular, because of the congressional schedule that we know looking ahead. The U.S. Congress is only in session for another 3 weeks before lawmakers go back to their home districts for the holiday break. The thinking is that House Democrats will draft articles of impeachment and hold a vote on them on the U.S. House floor before they leave for that Christmas and New Year's break. Mm. And that's in large part because U.S. public opinion has not been moving all that significantly during the course of these hearings.
Right.
That's definitely in House Democrats' minds.
And so then how much of the final vote will be influenced by public sentiments as seen through polling? Do the House members take that into consideration when they make the final vote?
House members actually look at their home districts more than the overall public opinion polling countrywide. So they're looking to see, of course, because they have elections coming up next year, too. They want to be reelected. They're going back to their home districts now and hearing from their constituents about what they feel about impeachment. I would expect any vote on articles of impeachment to fall hard along party lines. Republicans all voting against impeachment of President Trump, Democrats all voting for it.
That was VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. She joined me here in studio. Catherine, thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
A new report says that President Donald Trump learned about the whistleblower's complaint regarding his relations with Ukraine before he decided to unfreeze millions of dollars in military aid. The New York Times report cites two people familiar with the matter who say that White House lawyers told Mr. Trump about the complaint in late August as they worked to determine whether they were required to send it to Congress. For the White House reaction, I'm joined on phone by VOA's White House correspondent, Patsy Widakuswara. Hello, Patsy.
Hi there.
So why do these new revelations matter?
Well, essentially, so far at this point of the impeachment hearings, we know that Republicans have been claiming that there are two private remarks by President Trump that have cleared him of wrongdoing in the Ukraine scandal. The first remark was supposedly made to Senator Ron Johnson in August, saying that President Trump would never require Ukraine to do anything in order to get the military aid that he had suspended. The second remark, which is what we're talking about now, the remark that he made to U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, in September, was that President Trump wanted nothing from Ukraine, you know, the famous quid pro quo, no quid pro quo call. Well, and as you mentioned in the New York Times report, at that time that he made the call, President Trump had already been briefed on the whistleblower's complaints, and White House counsel is essentially explaining to him that they're trying to determine whether they have to give it to Congress as is legally required.
Right.
So in these investigations, the timeline matters, because if this report is accurate, this would indicate that President Trump wasn't telling the truth, but he was establishing his cover story, which, of course, has been cemented now as a White House and Republican talking point.
And how is the White House responding to these new revelations?
Well, they're responding to these new revelations the same way that they have been responding to everything else that's been going on in this impeachment hearing, is by, you know, just digging deep and digging their heels and essentially saying that this is all a sham by the Democrats, and Democrats are sore losers. They just want to take away the election results. So there's been no change in strategy from the White House. It's basically really hitting back and hitting back hard in terms of trying to sway public opinion to continue, at least for the base, to continue to believe in President Trump.
So there has been this talk that President Trump might at some point distance himself from his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. In his interview yesterday, he intimated that Mr. Giuliani might have been acting on his own in Ukraine. Can we read from this as the beginning of that process of what many have equated to, I guess, throwing him under the bus?
I believe that President Trump's assertions, it would seem that, you know, President Trump's statement to Bill O'Reilly saying that his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, was acting independently on Ukraine by denying that the president denying that he had directed Rudy Giuliani to go to Ukraine, does have a goal of distancing himself from Giuliani and potentially implicating himself further. We have to check this remark against scores of previous statements from Mr. Giuliani, from President Trump, and nearly a dozen of other current and former national security officials who testified in the impeachment inquiry that, you know, what President Trump is saying is definitely contradictory to what people have been saying in the impeachment inquiry.
That was VOA's White House correspondent Patsy Widakuswara. Patsy, thank you very much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Voice of America. This is the International Edition. My name is Jackson Munganyi. Among the top stories in the world, rescue efforts continue in Albania as citizens dig out from Tuesday's deadly earthquake. At least 26 people died in the quake, which hit the second largest city. More than 600 people are still missing. And the death of South Korean singer and actress Gu Hara this week is shining a spotlight on the pressure that K-pop stars face. She is the second pop star to die in the past month. At least two protesters died Wednesday in Baghdad when police fired on crowds. The country has been hit by a series of protests for weeks, with demonstrators calling for the government to step down or for a new fight against corruption. In Britain, polls show that Boris Johnson and the Conservatives are leading as voters prepare for general elections on December the 12th. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn's bid for Britain's top job is in jeopardy after renewed claims that he's not come out strongly against accusations of anti-Semitic attitudes in his party. VOA's Henry Ridgewell is in London. I asked him what triggered these latest accusations against Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, this was triggered by a written article written by the chief rabbi Ephraim Mervis in the UK yesterday on Tuesday, in which he said that there was a new poison sanctioned from the very top of the Labour Party of an unwillingness or an inability to tackle anti-Semitism within the party and among its members. This has been an ongoing issue with the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn in recent years. Many Jewish people and others have accused the party of not doing enough to tackle anti-Semitic views in the party. Mr. Corbyn himself insists that the party has got a grip on it, that anybody caught expressing anti-Semitic views is expelled from the party, but nevertheless it's an issue that has come back to haunt his Labour Party over the course of the election campaign. And then he did a television interview this week in which he refused to apologise for two Jewish people for any hurt that they had felt from anti-Semitic comments or anti-Semitic feeling from the Labour Party. Six times he was asked if he would apologise, and he refused to do so. And that has triggered a very negative backlash among many of the British electorate.
Right. Now, usually when politicians see that they have an opportunity at their prime spot, you know, they tone down or change their views on certain sticking issues or controversial issues, you know, like this one. How has Jeremy Corbyn responded to these accusations in the past? And has this, you know, his proximity to Downing Street changed how he speaks to it? Or has he been steadfast in his position?
Well, it's a very good point. Most leaders would, in fact, take the opportunity to try to gain as much of the electorate on their side as possible. And one would have thought, or his critics say, that Mr. Corbyn should have taken up that opportunity to apologise to the Jewish community for any hurt that had been caused. Many people say it wouldn't have done him any harm. His supporters say that people are confusing his support for the Palestinians and his anger with some of the recent policies of Israel with anti-Semitic feeling. And that is something that Mr. Corbyn has spoken of before. He's been a long-time supporter of what he says is peace in the Middle East and always supporting that peace process. But his critics, and many of those in the Jewish community, say that's not good enough. He just hasn't been hard enough on anti-Semitic comments and people within his own party. And it seems in the approach to the election date on December the 12th, he's not giving any more ground. He's sticking to his line that the Labour Party is doing enough to tackle this issue, and that it will protect all minorities and all religions, in his words, if he became Prime Minister.
Now, speaking of the Labour Party in general, there has been reports that in the past couple of years, the party has had some new members who are either vocal critics of Israel and believe that the UK and the US and others should be a little tougher towards Israel. How much of this is a reflection of the sentiments in the wider community of the electorate in the UK?
That's a very interesting question, because this issue of people entering the party doesn't just apply to the Labour Party, of course. It applies to the Conservatives under Boris Johnson as well. And we've seen a polarisation of both parties. And I think undoubtedly under Mr. Corbyn, the Labour Party has seen an influx of people who are probably more sympathetic to the Palestinian viewpoint in the Middle East and perhaps more critical of Israeli actions against the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And this debate over whether their pronouncement on Israeli policy and whether that enters into anti-Semitism is one that is very much alive. How much it reflects the opinion of the British electorate, well, I don't think that has really changed much. There aren't any polls that I know of that show exactly what the split in sympathies with the Palestinians and the Israelis are. But as you say, I think the fact is that both of the main parties here in Britain are changing very rapidly. Their membership is changing, their voters are changing, and that applies as much to the Labour Party as it does to the Conservatives as well.
Now, Henry, before I let you go, I wanted you to talk to us a little bit about this new story that we're reading this morning, that Labour has obtained official documents that show the U.S. government, or the U.S. is demanding that the NHS will be caught on the table in talks on a post-Brexit deal, trade deal. Why is this issue important to voters in the U.K.?
It's important because the NHS, the National Health Service, has always been a kind of sacred cow for British voters. And any time there's an election in Britain, the first thing the parties do is say, we're going to pump more money into the National Health Service. We're going to protect the National Health Service. So it becomes a real political football. And, of course, after Brexit, the supporters of that process and the Conservative Party, Boris Johnson among them, say that any losses we incur with Europe leaving the European Union will be made up for by great trade deals we'll make with the United States of America and others. And the Labour Party accused them of wanting to open up the National Health Service, which, let's not forget, is an industry worth hundreds of billions of pounds, to American providers, to American pharmaceutical companies who might be able to charge more for medicines, to American health providers. Whether that means Britain will actually do that and open up the NHS, or whether that's just the opening negotiating position of the United States government, that's what's being argued over at the moment. But certainly, I think this is some valuable ammunition for the Labour Party, and it might dent the Conservative lead a little bit in the polls. But they still remain somewhere between 10 and 15% ahead at this stage.
That's VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London. VOA's International Edition continues. Thousands of Palestinians demonstrated across the occupied West Bank yesterday. They were protesting against the recent announcement by the United States that it no longer believes Israel settlements in the West Bank violate international law. Reporter Linda Grastein is in Jerusalem and spoke to me a short time ago.
So yesterday, there was a day of rage against the American decision that was announced last week by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that Jewish settlements in the West Bank are not illegal. It doesn't actually change the reality on the ground, as most of the international community still says that settlements are illegal. But it was, for the Palestinians, one more example of how the Trump administration is completely pro-Israel. The first thing was moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, then recognizing Israeli annexation of the Golan Heights, and now saying that settlements are not illegal. And for Palestinians, this is a very big deal because for them, Jewish settlements are built in the West Bank, which they say must be part of a future Palestinian state. They say that the Palestinian state must be on the pre-1967 borders, meaning the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem.
What does international law say about these settlements, and how does this new U.S. policy contrast or differ with that policy?
So international law is pretty clear that an occupying power cannot make any major changes in the area that it's occupying, and therefore these settlements, which now have something like over 400,000 Israelis living in about 140 Jewish settlements in the West Bank, that doesn't count Israelis living in East Jerusalem, which Israel annexed. So Israel, first of all, says that East Jerusalem doesn't count, but East Jerusalem is part of its of Jerusalem. It's part of its capital. That's also not recognized. But it's pretty clear in international law that these settlements would violate international law. Israel says that since Jordan never legally controlled that area, it's not an occupied area. But that's how Israel justifies its continued expansion of settlements.
Now, this policy change was announced by U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo a couple of days ago. How do you explain that it took this long for the protests to start? Because usually in such announcements, protests are usually spontaneous. And what was the protest like?
Well, it takes a while to organize these kinds of things. You know, the protests were certainly violent, and you know, there were clashes with Israeli soldiers. But at the same time, you know, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has made it pretty clear that it doesn't want to go too far. It does not want an all-out conflict with Israel. So I think it was a question of it taking a while to organize it. They school kids were let out of school early in order to attend the protest, and there's a lot of anger, and it was certainly violent, but it did not really get out of control.
How does this decision by the U.S. help Netanyahu, given his political problems in Israel right now?
Well, I don't think this decision really helps Netanyahu, quite honestly. I mean, you know, it's everybody knows that Netanyahu is fairly close to President Trump. But he's facing a potential indictment on charges of bribery and fraud and breach of trust. And for the first time, those in the Likud, his party, the Likud, said that there should be primaries and there should be a new Likud leader. Mm-hmm. There was a big demonstration in Tel Aviv last night that was supposed to bring tens of thousands of people in support of Netanyahu. The turnout was pretty bad. It was just a few thousand, anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000, according to the police. And only one cabinet minister, Miri Regev, who's a staunch Netanyahu loyalist, came. So there's the sense that, you know, Netanyahu is kind of facing the beginning of the end of his rule. And it comes, you know, he's Israel's longest serving prime minister. He's been prime minister for the past 10 years, and then he had another term before then. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty big deal in Israeli politics.
That was Linda Granstein in Jerusalem. You're listening to Voice of America's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, South Sudan's president and chief rebel leader postponed the formation of a unity government for another 100 days. Inside the political turmoil in South Sudan, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The bodies of 16 Vietnamese migrants found dead in a truck in the UK in October arrived at Hanoi's Noi Bai Airport on Wednesday. Vietnam's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said that the bodies were taken in two ambulances and sent to the victims' home provinces. AP's Charles Ledesma reports.
The bodies of some of the victims found in a British truck are being repatriated to Vietnam. The bodies of 16 of the 39 Vietnamese who died when human traffickers carried them by truck to England last month have been flown back to their homeland and are being taken to their families. One father of an 18-year-old victim says he had been informed by a local government official that his son's remains will be brought home Wednesday, along with six other victims. The man told the AP, "I'm devastated, but I'll be happy to have him back with us soon." I'm Charles de Ledesma.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOAIE. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our producer, Nadia Taha. Our engineer has been Thomas Blondet. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Enjoy your day, everyone.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the International Day for the Disabled Persons is commemorated on December 3rd. Disability on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is Science in a Minute.
One of the most iconic features of planet Jupiter is its Great Red Spot. The Great Red Spot is actually an ongoing spinning storm vortex raging in its atmosphere. Scientists suggest the spot has been shrinking and that it could someday disappear. Researchers from the University of California, Berkeley, and Rice University in Houston, Texas, say reports of the demise of the Great Red Spot are greatly exaggerated. in findings presented at the annual meeting of the American Physical Society's Division of Fluid Dynamics, the researchers say there is no evidence the storm's vortex has changed in size or intensity. They did point to recent photos of large red flakes being ripped from the red spot, but that it is a very natural state of a vortex covered with clouds and not a sign of the Great Red Spot's death.